and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 21st, 2023. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, Corporate Interference and the Climate Crisis. Corporate interference, or corporate capture, refers to the means by which large corporations can and do influence politicians and political decision-making. We have to wonder, how does corporate interference affect the climate crisis in Canada? Our guests pondered this and more in our April political panel. This month's panel included MP Leah Gazan, Diana Yoon, and Gordon Laxer, hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
So, as mentioned, this month we'll be diving into corporate interference, or as it's sometimes called, corporate capture, and the climate crisis. How are these two concepts connected, and how can we move past our current status? So, we're going to start with Gordon. Gordon, your report, How Big Oil Captures Canadian Energy and Climate Policy, zeroes in on this key question of corporate influence in Canadian politics and policymaking. How entrenched is corporate control and what harm is it doing?
Well, what sparked my interest into researching corporate capture by big oil was their outlandish campaign before Alberta's last provincial election regarding what they called a very well-orchestrated, well-planned, foreign-funded attack on Canadian infrastructure, pipelines, LNG facilities. That was how Tim McMillan, the CEO of CAP, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, put it. CAP is the apex oil lobby group in Canada and is the biggest obstacle to effective climate action because it is the production rather than the consumption of oil and gas in Canada that's Canada's largest source of emissions. It's about a third of all emissions come from production of oil and gas. So you can't cut emissions by 40 to 45% in the next 6.5 years if you don't touch the emissions of the oil and gas industry. It's the biggest source. So it was crucial for me to research and refute CAP's fraudulent story. Now, CAP calls itself Canadian, gaily waves the maple leaf flag, and insinuates the Canadian environmentalists are traitors. Yet CAP is overwhelmingly foreign-funded and foreign-influenced itself. It uses the maple leaf flag as a fig leaf to cover its so much greater foreign-funded, foreign-influenced campaigns. CAP's call to shine light into the claim of a foreign-funded campaign to shut down, quote, our industry, was heard loud and clear by Jason Kenney, who announced that if elected, the United Conservative Party government would launch a war room and public inquiry to investigate foreign-funded anti-Alberta campaigns. Kenney headed the UCP into the 2019 Alberta election against the governing NDP led by Rachel Notley. The UCP won partly on the basis of this promise. What hypocrisy. Here was big foreign oil using lots of foreign funding to point fingers at a trickle of foreign money flowing to environmentalist tar sands campaign to curtail their harmful environmental impacts. Canadians need to hear what a fraud CAP's messaging is. So CAP's outsized foreign-funded meddling in Canadian elections far exceeded the impact of China's electoral interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections. The single-minded focus on China's meddling is sparking hate activity against Chinese Canadians who are not responsible for actions by the Chinese government. So let's shift the conversation. Big foreign oil's meddling is undermining Canadians' popular sovereignty to determine their own destiny. So Kenny, once he was elected, he appointed a forensic accountant, Steve Allen, to head of public inquiry. And by selecting a foreign a forensic accountant, it made it look like environmentalist actions were illegal. But Allen's inquiry found no improper or illegal activity and an annual flow of foreign money to the tar sands campaigns that was so little, it was less than the cost of the inquiry itself. And so embarrassed was he that the inquiry was headed by a prominent certified accountant, the normally staid newspaper of the national accounting profession called it a shambolic fiasco of a public inquiry. So I researched how foreign-owned big oil in Alberta is. I knew it was a lot, but was surprised at just how foreign-owned big oil in Canada is. Foreign-owned means foreign-funded. And here they've been tossing around foreign-funded as some kind of epithet. So there has not been a majority Canadian-owned oil corporation in Alberta sands since Suncor took over Petro-Canada in 2009. My posing as Canadian report shows that CAP gets about 97% of its revenue from its foreign-owned corporate members, and it uses it to employ 36 full-time lobbyists who lobbied Canadian federal officials on an average of five times a day between 2011 and 2018. In 2019, for the first time, CAP was allowed to register as a third-party advertiser. As such, in the 2019 election, it could spend up to $1.5 million before the election period and run ads supporting candidates and parties. Talk about meddling.
Gordon, hold you for a second. This is great stuff. And we're going to go to, in a second, to Diana to talk about how to counter corporate influence, specifically on the climate file. But this whole panel is a bit broader than that. So I want to bring other people in to talk about how entrenched corporate control is in general, if others want to comment on that. And specifically, mentioning what Gordon mentioned about this foreign influence thing. But do other folks want to talk about, again, corporate influence in general?
Well, just if you'd like me to contribute, Robin, certainly we see in Canada right now, it's not just in Canada, but globally, you know, the privileges of corporations really overriding the human rights of people. We see this certainly in Canada on Indigenous territories. Wet'suwet'en territory is a case in point with LNG. And the fact that it seems that the corporation privileges are usurping the rights of Indigenous peoples, and all governments are turning a blind eye to this kind of behavior. We have to remember that corporations are not rights holders, yet they seem to be privileged over the government's commitment to uphold the rights of certainly Indigenous peoples in Canada. And if you look at the current budget, and the focus of the current budget, it's on increased resource extraction in the country. Where's that coming from? It's going to be supported by Indigenous lands, territories, and resources. And there's no accountability to boot. Look at all the orphan wells across the country, big oil going into communities, you know, causing all sorts of environmental damage, such a great cost, not just financial cost, but environmental cost, human rights cost, leaving without having to even clean up their mess. And so I think this is something that we really need to look at in this country. This is something that I have certainly called out regularly as an elected official. And I think it's a real problem, particularly if you look at this budget, which will privilege the corporate elite.
Thanks, Leah. And let's swing over to Diana now. And Diana, as we noted in your introduction, you're a climate activist, and no doubt this question of corporate influence and power must come up all the time, exactly what Gordon has been speaking about, and back targeting environmental activists. So just two points, I guess, to you. What is your take on the influence of corporate lobbying and corporate power, particularly in Ottawa? And I think, interestingly, what strategies does the climate justice movement use to counter corporate influence?
Yeah, thanks, Libby. Great question. So to kind of go off the first question to Gordon, I think I will spend the majority of my remarks talking about climate activist strategies and how what that looks like, and particularly targeting big oil. But I think when I look at like the work I do professionally in the climate sector and in kind of intersection in climate and housing, we also see the influence of corporate interests there. Like, for example, when there are new development standards to reduce emissions in buildings, which is another significant source of emissions in the country, there has been repeated incidents of lobbying from, you know, housing developers against new efficiency standards. So, you know, I think when we look at kind of the corporate control, there has to be a real emphasis on understanding that green capitalism is really in play, that there are a lot of actors willing to capitalize on, okay, fine, like if this climate action stuff is trendy, if this is the direction we're going to go, then how can we still profit the most out of it? What are the ways that our companies can care as much as they can about that kind of profit, that bottom line? So, you know, I think that there's lots to talk about in the nuance of, I guess, in the spectrum of climate action, where corporate control can be. But I really wanted to kind of focus on two main strategies. So, like Leah said, Indigenous solidarity is one kind of key strategy the climate justice movement uses to counter corporate influence, and the other is fossil fuel divestment. So, you know, I think that climate justice movement activists really have to recognize that Indigenous, Black, and racialized communities have faced the worst impacts of the climate crisis and also have been on the front lines of fighting against natural resource extraction. Indigenous Climate Action had a report, Indigenous Resistance Against Carbon, which amplifies how resistance impacts the viability of fossil fuel expansion, and ultimately reduces the carbon in our atmosphere. What that means is activists can have and need to continue supporting Indigenous land defenders. It's not, you know, like Indigenous land defenders are separate from climate activists, and I think they often get lumped in the same into the same bucket. But I think it's really important to recognize that there's really, really incredible work happening by Indigenous land defenders. And one way to do that kind of solidarity, is to bring attention to some of these resistance actions across the country. So, you know, in 2016, I participated in a civil disobedience on Parliament Hill in Ottawa against the Trans Mountain, formerly Kinder Morgan pipeline. That was bringing it from the west to Ottawa, to Parliament Hill. And that, you know, raises awareness, makes it, you know, is trying to hold governments accountable. More recently, activists have held rallies in downtown Toronto in front of bank headquarters in support of the Wet'suwet'en. So I think that kind of key piece of what does it look like, even if, you know, you feel very far removed from Indigenous land defenders and your local communities, to amplify their work. I think, and then with fossil fuel divestment, I organized with Climate Justice Toronto locally now, but when I started, I was a undergrad student and I was part of the Queen's University campaign for fossil fuel divestment. You know, fossil fuel divestment as a whole, as a goal, works because it stigmatizes the fossil fuel industry. It kind of brings awareness of the hypocrisy of, you know, banks and of campuses, of all of the greenwashing, and to commitments that, you know, corporations and institutions have towards sustainability and climate action while actively courting, you know, oil and gas sponsorships and donations and funding fossil fuel projects. So, you know, I think that fossil fuel divestment has been a very effective strategy to start this conversation, to think about what it looks like to reinvest in clean energy and to get people involved in a way that feels tangible. Because, you know, tackling like RBC, the biggest fossil fuel financer in the world, may not feel so tangible for an individual or for a community group.
Okay, great strategies, Diana. Thanks.
Yeah, no, thanks, Diana. Kind of following up from that, and again, this is a question to everybody now. What does it say about the state of Canadian politics that there's such a strong connection between the private interests of corporations and government policy versus the overall public interest? What can we do about this clear conflict of interest? Why don't we start with Gordon?
Well, we've seen, you know, in the last 40 years, this whole ideology that, you know, the market always knows it better and governments should get out of the way. That it is terrible for the climate because the private interests almost always when they're making record profits, it's especially in Canada, it's through resource extraction. It's always producing more stuff, and it's doing it in a very damaging way that doesn't necessarily support the workers and the communities that where they're the employer. So we have to really get a much stronger sense that we have interests in common, that we share our commons, and this is the basis of democracy. Is it has to be the people that, you know, I ask. I was a political economist. I'm a political economist. What's an economy for? Whose economy is it? The economy should not be just for the rich to make money. It should be something that serves all of us. And we have to get to a place where that happens and that is going to have a much lighter touch on the environment.
Thanks. Leah, you want to jump in on that one?
Well, I think, you know, certainly the ballot box, I mean, we are at a critical juncture, I think, politically in this country. I think it's becoming more apparent and people need to know who they're voting for and what they support. Like, you know, I think it would be worth noting that the federal government has several meetings, you know, meetings upon meetings with the oil lobbyists. They refuse to divest from fossil fuels in a real way. And I think Canadians need to, or voters, and whether you can vote or not, need to send a clear message that this isn't acceptable. You know, I worry about the state of affairs of this country when we're not going after the ultra wealthy to pay their fair share. You know, I know the NDP has focused a lot on Loblaws. He's one culprit. Galen Weston is one corporate culprit amongst many. And I would say, you know, looking at certainly the oil and gas sector and the kind of allowances that they're given by, you know, consecutive Liberal and Conservative governments, quite frankly, they're the only parties that have governed in this country. I think it's time for people to take a pause. These are not parties of for the people. You know, corporations, when we're talking about, whether it's, you know, climate, you know, housing, you know, these are not parties of the people or the worker or the worker being exploited in the resource extraction industries. Parties that are supporting aggressive resource extraction like the current Liberal government, you know, profiting resource extraction companies. They're not also requiring those same companies to make sure if you're going to exploit the natural resources, particularly on Indigenous lands, territories, and resources, you better have something in place to ensure that Indigenous women and girls are safe. Because we know through the Status of Women Committee, there's a direct correlation between resource extraction and increased violence against Indigenous women and girls. And whether you agree with resource extraction or not, You know, women and girls and diverse gender folks have a right to safety and security. So we all currently have a government that's saying we're going to exploit our natural resources, not talking about the fundamental human rights of Indigenous peoples, not talking about the safety of Indigenous women, girls, and diverse gendered people. We need to take a moment of pause, and we need to tell elected officials and tell governments what we think at the ballot box.
I think to Leah's point, like I'm really hearing like, do our governments care about putting people before profit, right? And making sure that people are protected, making sure that I guess that is the public interest, right? And when I see governments continue, you know, like the federal government continuing fossil fuel subsidies, that I think we often hear, you know, well, where's the money for X, Y, and Z? And I think that that is one example of where the public interest gets eroded to benefit private corporations. And because I guess, like Gordon said, this is all getting lobbied.
Yeah. And well, just coming back to Leah, you mentioned just a moment ago that it's important that we tell elected officials what we think at the ballot box. And it made me think, what do we do in between that? So a couple questions back to you. You did touch on how powerful corporate lobbying is and its influence on Parliament Hill. So a couple questions. What protection do we have against excessive corporate influence on the Hill, and what protections do we still need? I mean, are there laws in place about lobbying that give us some protection, or is it something that's just totally inadequate?
Well, I mean, there's ethics codes, certainly. We hear about them being violated on a daily in the House of Commons right now.
Like, yeah.
It's true. Like, you know, like as members of Parliament, we have to follow, we have very strict ethics rules.
A small segment from our most recent live panel, Off the Hill, Corporate Interference and the Climate Crisis. We'd like to extend a thank you to our guests who appeared on this week's panel, and a thank you to our brilliant audience members for their engaging questions. To watch the full panel, please visit rabble.ca/rabbletv or visit our YouTube channel. If you missed this month's event and don't want to miss the next one, be sure to sign up for email reminders for events such as this at rabble.ca/alerts. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll hand it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in Canadian politics, National Politics reporter Stephen Wentzel reports on how Indigenous and other racialized stakeholders who oppose the Royal Bank of Canada's investment in fossil fuels were purposely excluded from RBC's recent annual general meeting. RBC is the primary financier of the Coastal GasLink pipeline, which runs through Indigenous Wet'suwet'en territory. Last year alone, RBC handed out over $40 billion to fossil fuel companies. Wet'suwet'en leaders and other stakeholders were kept in an empty room separate from the AGM and were largely ignored by RBC. Shaylee Holland, a Wet'suwet'en youth, called RBC's decision to fund fossil fuel companies at record rates hypocritical and morally wrong. Also in Canadian politics, Conservative leader and leader of the official opposition, Pierre Poilievre, this week invited American billionaire and Twitter owner Elon Musk to interfere in Canadian politics by targeting Canada's public broadcaster, the CBC. On April 11th, Poilievre sent a letter to Musk asking that the CBC be labeled as government-funded media on Twitter, a request which Musk obliged. A significant amount of the CBC's budget does come from government sources, but that funding does not have an impact on CBC's independent news coverage. The CBC and American public broadcaster NPR have both suspended their use of Twitter in response to the incorrect labeling. Media critic John Miller explains, quote, "Surely we Canadians know enough about the CBC to know that if the federal government tried anything like that, the CBC president, its board of directors, and its entire newsroom of journalists would go to the mat to fight it," end quote. In environmental news, Michael Polanyi of Nature Canada gave 5 reasons to be hopeful this Earth Day. Despite fears that the climate could warm by as much as 2.6 degrees Celsius this century, Polanyi explained that there was a host of efforts currently underway to curb the worst effects of global warming. Polanyi cites that countries around the world are creating action plans to help reduce carbon in the atmosphere. Importantly, more efforts are being made to partner with some of our most key allies in the fight to save the Earth, including through indigenous-led initiatives, through efforts to protect trees, and efforts to partner with nature itself. Polanyi writes, quote, "This Earth Day, let's remember, nature lovers are in the majority. We have power, and together we can build an equitable and compassionate world for all people, and the millions of species with whom we share our home," end quote. Also this week, Rabble is undertaking a vegan challenge by sharing some of our favorite vegan recipes, as well as tips for eating vegan on a budget. Karishma Joshi shared how she's able to live vegan on a grocery budget of just $400 a month. In addition to buying foods that have a long shelf life, like frozen fruits and vegetables, nuts, and organic chickpea pasta, Joshi also recommends buying in bulk and letting nothing go to waste. One example of not wasting anything, Joshi explained, is by using dried onion peels to make onion powder to use as a spice and flavoring in other dishes. Some of the Rabble team's favorite vegan recipes include curry butternut squash soup, chewy chocolate chip pumpkin cookies, and lentils and vegetables over couscous. Give these recipes a try. Not only are they delicious, but they also reduce your carbon footprint and help the environment. Finally, happy birthday to Rabble.ca. This week, Rabble is celebrating 22 years of sharing progressive news and views, and it's all thanks to the support from our Rabble Rousers. Thanks to the financial support of Rabble Rousers like you, Rabble can continue to publish journalism that matters, reporting on the news from progressive social and labor movements, and providing context and analysis to national and world events that you will not find elsewhere. Help us celebrate our birthday. We're giving away vegetable seed packets, books, and our new union-made tote bag to new donors. Become a Rabble Rouser today at rabble.ca/donate. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes only 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you as always to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.